personal collection with the island, and who was this friend? Mitch's first thought was that it might be Grace herself. Had she contacted him somehow and persuaded him to meet? Perhaps, as two criminals on the run from the U.S. justice system, she convinced John that she was prepared to let bygones be bygones. If so, Mitch was certain. She was luring him into a death trap. Mitch had called Caroline Merrivale, woken her up. "Has John ever been to Madagascar? Does he have any acquaintances there?" Caroline's answer had hardened Mitch's hunch into certainty. He knew where John was. He knew where Grace was headed. But could he get there in time to prevent the inevitable? "I'd like a ticket for that fight, please. The 9 o'clock." She looked at her screen again. "Oh, dear. I'm afraid it's fully booked. Shall I put you on standby?"
"Breathe deeply. Count to 5.
"Sure." Mitch tried Harry Bain again. On the floor next to Harry Bain's sleeping bag, his cell phone vibrated quietly. It was 5 a.m. at the Iserlohn National Park campsite. Outside, hikers were already warming up cups of coffee over the breakfast campfire and checking the settings of their cameras. The big thing at Iserlohn was the bird life. You could never get up too early to watch birds. Unlike his fellow campers, Harry Bain had no interest in snapping a crested koa or catching a rainbow-plumed coracidae feeding its young. He'd come to Talaria in search of the lesser-spotted Merrivale, but the whole thing had been another wild goose chase. Whoever left him that note was either deliberately playing games with him or had gotten his signals crossed. The rangers at Iserlohn had the combined IQ of a dung beetle. None of them had seen John. Harry Bain wanted to get back to Antananarivo last night, but he'd left it too late. Reluctantly, he settled in for a night's sleep in the park. His phone buzzed 5 or 6 times like a dying wasp, then fell silent. Thanks to his trusty foam earplugs, Harry Bain slept on oblivious. Grace slipped off her backpack. Inside were a length of rope, pliers, a stick of chalk, a square black piece of cloth, and a dictaphone tape recorder. Tying a simple slipknot at one end of the rope, she threw it over the lowest part of Le Concon's fortress-like outer wall, aiming for a metal rod that jutted out below one of the bathroom windows. Lassoing was harder than it looked. It took Grace more than 10 minutes to snag the rod, minutes in which she looked anxiously over her shoulder for early morning pedestrians. The dawn had broken slowly at first, but now daylight seemed to flood the alley, shining on Grace as aggressively as any police flashlight. Rubbing chalk onto her hands, she gripped the rope and began pulling herself up. The wall was as smooth as newly shaven skin and slick with moisture from the air. Even with her climbing shoes, it was tricky to get a firm grip. With every slip, every lost footing, the strain on Grace's triceps increased fivefold till her arms started to shake. Halfway up, she thought desperately, "I'm not going to make it. I can't hold out." She could feel the rope chafing against her palms, the sweat of her efforts washing away the chalk. She started to slide, imperceptibly at first, but then faster and more surely back down toward the street. Voices. Girls' voices or young women. They were giggling, gossiping to one another in French. Grace couldn't make out what they were saying, but it didn't matter. Their conversation grew louder.
"They'll be here any second. They'll see me."
Grace looked up. There was another 15 feet to the top of the wall. Her hands were still slipping, her feet scrabbling for purchase. The voices were even louder now. Gripping the rope, Grace forced herself to move upward. She had no energy left, yet somehow she kept going, powered by determination. It wasn't about saving herself. It was about destroying John Merrivale.
On the other side of that wall is the man who killed Lenny. The man who took everything from you. He's living in your house, hiding in your sanctuary, spending your money.
Rage was like a turbocharger in Grace's chest, pulling her up, propelling her on. Her hands were bleeding now, blood mingling with the sweat on her palms as the rope lacerated her skin, but Grace felt nothing. She could see the top. She could touch it. Swinging her legs over to the other side of the wall, she pulled the rope up behind her. The girls were directly below her now, three of them. Dressed in supermarket uniforms, they were on their way to work. Grace waited for them to stop and point. The bottom of the rope was less than 2 feet from where they were walking, but they continued on their way, laughing and joking with one another. Happy. Grace felt a pang of envy mingled with her relief as she watched their backs disappear from sight. Then she pulled up the rope, turned around, and lowered herself into Le Cocon's courtyard garden. Mitch looked out of the plane window. There was nothing to see but clouds, thick and gray and impenetrable. Next to him, a young woman whimpered with fear as the aircraft bucked like a wild bull, juddering its way through the turbulent sky. Mitch tried not to think about Grace, or John Merrivale, or what might already have happened back in Antananarivo. If this were New York, he'd radio the local police for backup, get them to deal with it. But the last thing he wanted was a bunch of trigger-happy Madagascans storming Le Cocon. Where the hell was Harry Bane when you needed him? Grace edged her way around the courtyard with her back to the wall. Le Cocon was a vast house, a maze of corridors and bedrooms and little hidden gardens and terraces. She would begin the search inside the house, but first she had to disable the security alarm, cameras, and phone line. Lenny used to complain about the archaic systems at Le Cocon. "Have you seen the wires out there? It looks like something from a bad 70s sci-fi movie." But he never got around to replacing them. Grace was banking on the fact that Jan Barines wouldn't have got around to it either. Edging towards the back kitchen door, she saw to her relief that he hadn't. One arthritic closed circuit camera pointed towards the same old fuse box that had been there in her and Lenny's day. Approaching the camera from behind, Grace covered it with a black cloth she'd brought with her. Then, pulling out her pliers, she advanced towards the fuse box. Mitch's plane hit the tarmac with a violent bump. The woman next to him made the sign of a cross and offered up a little prayer of thanks. Mitch was not a religious man, but he, too, started to pray. "Don't let me be too late." Harry Bane rubbed his eyes. For a moment, he forgot where he was. He'd been in the middle of a wonderful dream. He was in New York at Sweetie Pie, one of his favorite restaurants on Greenwich Avenue, salivating over a hot fudge sundae, when some a-hole started shaking him by the shoulders. "Camp's packing up now. If you want a ride to the airport, you better get up now." Madagascar. Isolo. John Bastard Merrivale. Gloomily, he reached for his phone. The red message light flashed at him reproachfully. Harry flipped it open and hit the key for voicemail. "You have 7 new messages."
7?
He sat up and listened. Grace leaned on the kitchen door. It opened immediately.
"John must feel safe here, like we did."
There were only 2 places in the world where she and Lenny had routinely left their doors unlocked: Madagascar and Nantucket. John had ruined the memory of both of those places, poisoned them, like he poisoned everything he touched. Hugging her hatred to her like a security blanket, Grace crossed the dark room. It was eerie. Above her head hung copper pots and pans, shadowy and immobile like a set of unloved puppets. In front of her, the enormous triple-fronted cook stove gleamed, pristine and untouched. Next to it, on the countertop, Grace noticed that someone had recently bought, unwrapped, and plugged in a basic microwave oven. Its box could still be seen in the corner, propped up on top of the trash can. Typical. A single man moves into a house with a fully equipped gourmet kitchen, and the first thing he does is buy himself a microwave. Grace found herself wondering if John had used it yet, and if so, what he had prepared. She hoped it was delicious, whatever it was. It didn't seem right to eat a horrible last meal. The inner kitchen door opened into a small flagstone pantry, which in turn led to stairs. These were originally the servants' stairs, and they ran all the way from the cellar to the attic on the west side of the house. Grace drew her gun. It was Gavin Williams's gun, but she thought of it as hers now, and started to climb. The house was not just quiet. It was silent. Grace could hear her own breath, the soft rustle of her clothes as she moved, the creak of the water pipe. It was only a few days since she'd last been here, sitting in the library with the kindly Jamboreens. But something seismic seemed to have happened to the place in the interim. It was more than just the absence of furniture and people. Barines' staff had gone, and John had clearly moved in alone. It was as if the house itself had died. As if John's presence had forced all the life and the joy out of it, like albumen from a straw-blown egg. All that was left was the shell. Suddenly, a door slammed. The noise was so loud and so unexpected, Grace opened her mouth to scream, but stopped herself, stifling the sound with her hands. She'd almost reached the second floor, but the noise had come from below, at ground level. As quietly as she could, Grace turned around. On this floor, the door from the servants' stairs opened into a large marble-floored atrium. It was shaped like a pentagon with five floor-to-ceiling archways, giving on to various reception rooms. The library and the study faced inward, toward Lake Hong Kong's small central courtyard, but the dining and living rooms opened into the main garden, each with a set of French doors. Grace stepped cautiously into the atrium, looking around her, listening for a second sound, some sign to guide her. She felt a soft breath of wind on her face. The drawing room doors were open into the garden. Grace took a step toward them, then stopped. There he was. She saw him from behind, walking out into the garden, still in his pajamas and bathrobe. He had a coffee mug in one hand and a book in the other, and he looked like any tourist on vacation. His red hair was unkempt, sticking up at strange angles from where he'd slept on it. Grace was struck by how small he looked, how slight, how normal. If one were to form a mental picture of a brutal murderer, it would not be this harmless, shambling middle-aged man. She had not seen John in the flesh since her trial. Her last memory of him was his pained face as she was led from the dock. "Don't worry," he mouthed to her. Grace thought back to the terror of those first days in custody, the van ride to Bedford, being beaten to near death by Cora Buds. Back then, she still believed John Merrivale would rescue her. He was her friend, her only friend. She released the safety catch on the gun. "John!" He didn't hear her. Grace moved closer, walking at first, then running.
John!
He turned around. At the sight of the gun, his face drained of color. The coffee mug fell from his hand, shattering into 1,000 pieces on the paved stone of the terrace. Instinctively, he moved to one side, covering his head with his hands. As he did so, Grace saw for the first time that he was not alone. Behind him, sprawled out in a lawn chair, was another man. The second man turned 3/4 away from Grace, facing the garden rather than back toward the house. At first, she could only see the top of his head and his slippered feet stretched out in front of him, but still a shiver of familiarity shot through her. Something about his posture, his body language.
I know you.
She stood transfixed as the man slowly turned. Even before she saw his face, she knew. The languid, unconcerned way he moved, as if the commotion behind him and John Merrill's cowering terror didn't bother him in the least. Grace had met only one man with that confidence, that total, unshakable sang-froid.
Hello, Gracie.
Lenny Brookstein smiled.
I've been waiting for you.
Chapter 37. Grace watched her life flash before her eyes. Was this a dream or a nightmare? Part of her wanted to touch Lenny, to stick her hands in his sides like a doubting Thomas and prove that he was real. But something made her hesitate.
I saw you. I saw your body.
She was shaking.
I went to the morgue, for God's sake.
Why don't you put the gun down?
Lenny's voice sounded soothing, hypnotic.
We can talk.
Grace was about to do as he asked when John Merrill took a step toward her. Instinctively, she swung the gun in his direction and stepped back, her finger hovering over the trigger.
Don't move!
She shouted. John stepped back.
Sit down on that chair. Put your hands where I can see them.
John did as he was asked, sinking down into the lawn chair beside Lenny's. Grace looked at Lenny.
You too?
Lenny raised an eyebrow, in admiration as much as surprise. He, too, put his hands on his lap. Keeping the pistol trained on the pair of them, Grace reached into her backpack and pulled out the dictaphone. She pressed the record button and set it down on the ground before them.
Talk,
she commanded. Lenny couldn't take his eyes off Grace's face.
So beautiful. But she's changed. I suppose she had to. She's stronger. That sweet, trusting little girl could not have survived. What do you want to know?
Everything. I want to know everything, Lenny. I want to know the truth.
Lenny Brookstein started talking. Chapter 38.
What you have to remember, Grace, is how long ago this all started. You were a tiny child when I founded Quorum, 4, maybe 5 years old. I had a couple of funds before that, made a little money, but I always knew Quorum would be different. I set out to rule the world, and I did.
Lenny looked at John Merrill and smiled. John smiled back, a look of blind adoration on his face. Grace remembered that look from the old days.
He loves him. John's always loved Lenny. How could I have forgotten that?
Lenny went on, warming to his theme.
In the early days of the fund, it was a struggle. It was the beginning of the 90s. The economy was in the tank. People were losing their jobs, their homes. No one wanted to invest. Remember now, I staked every cent I owed on Quorum. Every cent!
If she went down, I'd be back at the bottom. Poor again. In my 40s, penniless.
Lenny's face darkened.
You can't imagine the fear, Gracie. How terrifying that was, coming from where I came from. The idea that I might have to go back to the dirt, the violence, the hunger. No, it wasn't going to happen to me.
He said this angrily, almost as if it were Grace who had tried to bring him down.
And thanks to John here,
it didn't.
John Merrill flushed with pleasure, like a teenage girl being complimented by the high school quarterback. Grace listened in silence.
I had a great model, foolproof, actually. But at the time, a guy like me with no formal education was seen as way too much of a risk. I couldn't sell a dollar for 90 cents, but this guy, he nodded at John, this guy had the heads of those Swiss pension funds eating out of his hands like a flock of lambs. It was thanks to those early institutional investors that we rode out the storm. But it was the small investors that really made us what we became. The mom-and-pop stores, the little charities that gave us their money. You know, Madoff and Sanford and all those guys, they were a bunch of snobs. If you didn't belong to the right golf club or come from the right family, those bastards would turn your money away. Turn it away. That made me sick. Like, who the hell were they to tell ordinary people they can't get a taste of the good life? That the American dream was closed to them. Quorum wasn't like that. We loved the little guy, and we made him rich, and he made us rich for a long, long time. People always gloss over that part.
Lenny's anger was back and growing. Grace had heard about as much self-righteousness as she could stomach.
Those people, those little guys,
she spat the words back at him, still feeling like she was talking to a ghost, but unable to hold herself back any longer.
They lost everything because of Quorum. Everything. Families were made destitute because of what you did. Charities closed their doors. People, young men with families, have killed themselves because of...
Cowards. Lenny shook his head in disgust.
Imagine killing yourself because you lost money. That's not tragic. It's pathetic.
I'm sorry, Grace, but it is. You make an investment, you take a risk. No one forced them to give me their goddamn money. Grace was horrified by how much she wanted to shoot him. One squeeze of the trigger and she could stop him talking there and then. Stop this obese, heartless apparition, this ghost, destroying the Lenny she remembered, the Lenny she had loved, the Lenny she had believed in and had needed to believe in her whole adult life. But as deeply as his words hurt her, she felt compelled to hear them. She had to know the truth.
Anyway, he went on, for years it was good. Everyone was happy. Then, around 2000, things started to go wrong. That was the tech boom, the rise of the internet, and it was a crazy time. Just crazy. Overnight, every business model, every investment strategy you ever know got turned on its head. Young kids, still in college, some of them, were founding businesses that never made a red cent, then turning him around and selling him for billions of dollars in 18 months flat. Everywhere you looked, people were launching rockets and everyone was trying to grab one by the tail. All the old dinosaurs like me, pick the right startup and hold the hell on for the ride.
Lenny's eyes lit up with excitement at the memory.
That was around the time I met you, honey. The happiest time of my life. I've always loved you, you know.
He looked at Grace, his eyes welling with tears. Grace thought,
he means it. He's insane. After everything he's done to me, he thinks he can talk about love?
Aloud, she said only, go on.
Letty shrugged.
It's pretty straightforward after that.
I made a lot of internet investments, bought a bunch of speculative businesses, and I took a bath. Between 2001 and 2003, I must have lost... He looked at John Merivale for confirmation.
I don't know.
A lot. 10 billion.
At least,
said John.
How is that possible?
Grace interrupted.
How is it possible?
You take a bet and you lose. That's how. We just took big bets.
I mean, how come nobody knew about it?
Because I didn't tell them, said Lenny.
What am I, stupid? I was careful, Gracie. I covered my tracks. We got creative with our financial statements. It's easier than you might think in a business as complex and diverse as Quorum to make your assets look bigger than they are and to hide your liabilities. We stopped logging trades, destroyed a bunch of paper and computer records. We kept the funds we did have moving constantly from one jurisdiction to another. The SEC sniffed around a bit in 2003 and 2005, but it never opened an official investigation. So you lied. You lied to your investors, the little guys who trusted you, just like you lied to me.
I was protecting them, and you,
Lenny shouted.
Protecting me?
If it hadn't been happening to her, Grace might have laughed.
Sure. Don't you see? As long as nobody panicked, as long as they all stuck with me, I could make that money back. I'd already started to do it, Grace. That's the fucking irony. All those destitute families you want me to cry over, they're the ones who got us all into this mess, not me.
If they hadn't all tried to cash in at once, pulling their money out like a herd of frightened, stupid sheep following each other off a cliff. He threw his arms up in despair.
I could have made things right. I could have, but I never got the chance. After Bear went down, then Lehman, it was mayhem. Those bastards destroyed everything I ever worked for. They sank my ship, and I couldn't stop them. All I could do was make sure I didn't go down with them. I had to survive, Grace. I had to survive.
John came up with the idea of the boat. We'd do it on Nantucket. Make it look like a suicide. At first we thought I could just disappear, you know, missing, presumed dead. But I couldn't leave anything to chance. Knowing the storm that would be unleashed at Quorum, I didn't want some vigilante out there looking for me. We had to have a body. Grace started to shiver.
The stump in the morgue. Davy Bucola's pictures. The severed head. He couldn't have... You mean you killed somebody?
He was a nobody. A homeless bum from the island. A lazy drunk, trust me. He'd have been dead in a few months anyway, the way he was treating his liver. I just speeded things up a little. Took him out on the boat, gave him a bottle of bourbon, and left him to it. When he was passed out cold, I did what needed to be done. Grace put her hand over her mouth. She felt the vomit rise up inside her.
Yeah, it wasn't pretty.
Lenny winced in distaste.
But, like I say, it had to be done. The cops would have to think that the corpse was me, so I had to... alter it.
The hardest part was getting my wedding ring onto his finger. He was stiff by then and so fucking fat. Plus, of course, there was the storm. We hadn't figured on that. A couple of times I nearly did go overboard. I tell you, I've never been happier to see Graydon in my life.
Graydon. Graydon Walker.
It was a name from another life. Grace and Lenny's helicopter pilot, Graydon Walker, was a quiet, taciturn man. Grace had never really warmed to him, but like many of the longtime Brookstein staff, he was fanatically loyal to Lenny.
Graydon took me to a quiet airstrip on the mainland. Dez had the jet waiting, brought me straight here.
Desmond Montalbano was the pilot of their G5, a young, ambitious ex-fighter pilot with a taste for daredevilry.
I knew Graydon would keep the secret, but I wasn't sure about Dez.
Grace gasped.
You didn't kill Dez.
Kill him? Of course not.
Lenny sounded offended by the suggestion.
I structured his compensation over 30 years, made it worth his while to keep his trap shut.
He's paid out of a trust in Jersey. That money's completely untraceable, he added with a touch of pride.
It's all completely untraceable, said Grace bitterly. Who hid the rest of the money? You? John?
Lenny smiled.
Darling Grace, haven't you figured it out yet? There is no rest of the money.
Grace looked at him blankly.
What do you mean? I mean, this mythical 70-plus billion everyone's so busy looking for, it doesn't exist. It never did exist.
Grace waited for him to explain.
Oh, Quorum was making money all right. We were trading. Up until the internet losses, we were doing well. Perhaps 20 billion in our heyday. Never over 70. In any event, by 2004, it was all gone.
All gone?
There was a few hundred million left. I was using that to pay dividends and cover occasional redemptions, and to bankroll our lifestyle, of course. I always wanted you to have the best, Gracie.
Grace thought about the nightmare of the past 2 years of her life.
You wanted me to have the best?
She murmured.
Yeah. People think success is measured in wealth, but it's not. Not in America. It's measured by the perception of wealth. If people perceived me as wealthy and successful, they would continue to lend to me. And they did. Until Lehman went down. After that, everyone got jumpy. People started to do the math, and I knew I had to create an exit strategy. I put some money aside for myself and John. We didn't need much. We always planned to live simply, didn't we?
John nodded.
Madagascar's a simple island, Grace. You know that. That's why you and I both loved it so much. You know, I'm so happy you're here, darling.
He stood up and threw his arms wide, as if expecting her to embrace him.
It'll be like old times, the three of us together again.
I've missed you, Gracie. More than you know.
Won't you put the gun down?
Let bygones be bygones. Grace laughed, a loud, joyless roar of a laugh. She laughed till her body shook and tears streamed down her face. Then she stood up and pointed the gun between Lenny's eyes.
Bygones! Bygones! Have you totally lost your mind? You set me up. You stole and murdered and lied and cheated, and you left me to take the fall. I went to the morgue, Lenny. I saw that corpse, that bloated hulk of the poor man you killed, and I wept. I wept because I thought it was you. I loved you.
And I loved you, Grace.
Stop it! Stop saying that! You left me for dead, worse than dead. You had John rig my trial. They locked me up and threw away the key, and you let it happen. You made it happen. My God! I believed in you, Lenny. I thought you were innocent.
She shook her head bitterly.
All this time, everything I've been through, it's all been for you, for your memory.
The memory of who I thought you were. Do you know why I came here today?
Lenny shook his head.
To kill John. That's right. I was going to shoot him because I thought he murdered you. I thought he'd stolen the money and framed you.
John?
Betray me?
Lenny seemed to find this idea amusing.
My dear girl, the entire world had betrayed me, and you single out the man, the only man, whose loyalty who has never been in question? That's priceless.
What about my loyalty, Lenny? My love? I'd have given anything for you, risked anything, suffered anything. Why didn't you trust me? You could have talked to me when things started going wrong at Quorum.
Talked to you? About business? Oh, come on, Grace. You never looked at the price tag on anything in your life.
It was true. Grace looked back at the naive, idiotic person she'd been back then, and felt ashamed.
Look, perhaps I should have trusted you, Gracie. Perhaps I should have.
For the first time, a look that might have been guilt passed briefly across Lenny's features.
I did love you. But it's like I said, I had to survive. People wanted a scapegoat for their own stupidity. Quorum's investors. America. The world. They wanted a sacrificial lamb to atone for their own greed. It was you or me, darling.
He shrugged.
And you chose me.
Grace's finger caressed the trigger.
You heartless son of a bitch.
John Merrivale whimpered in fear.
Please, Grace!
Lenny asked,
"What do you want me to say, Grace? That I'm sorry?"
Grace thought about it.
"Yes. I would like you to say you're sorry, Lenny. I'd like you to say you're sorry for that poor man you butchered. Sorry for the millions of people whose lives you destroyed. Sorry for me, for what you did to me. Say you're sorry. Say it!"
She was screaming now, hysterical. Lenny looked at her dispassionately, the way one might observe a rampaging animal in a zoo.
"No, I won't say it. Why should I? Because I'm not sorry, Grace. I'm not. And if I had a chance to do it all over again, I'd do it exactly the same way."
Desperately, Grace searched his face for any sign of the man she remembered. Any hint of compassion, of remorse. But Lenny's eyes blazed with defiance.
"I'm a survivor, Grace. That's what I am. My father survived the Holocaust. He came to America with nothing but the shoes on his feet. And yes, he made a god-awful mess of his life, but that was only because he was poor. He survived. That's the point. He had a life, and he gave me life, and I devoted my life to escaping poverty. I wasn't going to make the mistakes he made. I wasn't going to be a second-class citizen, another poor little Jewish boy begging to be let into the goddamn country club. I owned the country club, okay? I owned it. I had all these preppy Protestant Walker Montgomery III's begging me for acceptance. I even married one of their daughters."
Grace winced.
"Is that all I ever was to you? Cooper Knowles's daughter? A status symbol? You expect me to apologize for surviving? For fighting to the end? Never. I came from nothing, Grace. From less than nothing. I built Quorum up out of dust."
He quivered with anger.
"What do you know about hard work? About prejudice? About poverty? About suffering?"
Grace thought about the grinding days at Bedford Hills, about living hand to mouth on the run from the law, knowing the entire world would prejudice against her, that not a soul on earth knew the truth. She thought about fighting off rapists, of bleeding half to death from a self-induced abortion, of slashing her wrists with the pin of a brooch.
What do I know about suffering? You'd be surprised.
Lenny went on.
You were the American princess. Life handed you everything on a plate and you took it, accepted it as your due, as your right. You never asked where it came from. You didn't care, so don't stand there and try to take the moral high ground with me. I'm sorry that you suffered, Grace, but someone had to. Maybe it was your turn.
My turn?
Yeah. Don't look so horrified, darling. You made it out, didn't you? You learned to survive yourself. I'm proud of you. You're here. You're alive. You're free.
We all are.
You wanted the truth, and now you've got it. What more do you want?
And that's when Grace knew for sure.
Vengeance, Lenny. I want vengeance.
The shot rang out, its echo bouncing off the high stone walls. Lenny touched his chest. Blood seeped through his fingers, soaking his white linen shirt. He looked up at Grace, surprised. John Merrivale screamed, "No!" Another shot was fired. Then another. Grace. Grace turned. Mitch Connors was running through the drawing room towards the garden, his blonde hair stuck to his forehead with sweat, his gun drawn.
Stop. But she couldn't stop.
John Merrivale had run into the house. Grace swung back to face Lenny, but he was gone too.
No.
Then she saw him, crawling toward the summer house on his hands and knees, a thick trail of blood staining the ground behind him. Grace took aim again. She raised her arm to shoot, but Mitch Connors ran past her, throwing his arms wide to make a human shield between Grace and Lenny.
It's over, sweetheart. Stop. Please, put the gun down.
Grace screamed.
Get out of my way, Mitch. Move!
No. This isn't right, Grace. I know you want justice, but this isn't the way.
Lenny was getting away. She couldn't bear it.
Move, Mitch. I swear to God, I'll shoot.
She heard a commotion inside the house. Doors slamming. Men running. Through Mitch's legs, she saw Lenny had almost reached the safety of the summer house. Out of the corner of her eye, she saw John Merrivale running out of the house, screaming, waving a shotgun. The footsteps behind her grew louder.
Police! Drop your weapons!
It was now or never. Grace fired her gun for the last time. She watched in horror as Mitch pirouetted on the grass, the bullet tearing through his flesh.
Mitch!
She screamed, but no sound came out. The razors were tearing at her, too, her side, her arms, her legs. She was on the grass, bleeding. Sound faded. Grace opened her eyes to a silent ballet of running feet. Mitch was still, slumped on the lawn. She looked for Lenny, but she couldn't see him. Only the red haze of her own blood, blotting out the sun and the skies and the trees, falling. Falling heavy like thick velvet on the theater stage. Her final curtain. Chapter 39. New York, 1 month later. The woman in the hospital waiting room whispered to her daughter.
Is it her?
The daughter shook her head.
I don't think so.
Normally, she wouldn't have been so hesitant. She was a great one for all the gossip magazines and prided herself on being able to spot a celebrity from 50 yards. Sunglasses and headscarves didn't fool her. But in this case,
The woman did look a bit like her. A lot like her if he broke down her face feature by feature. The cupid's bow lips, the childlike dimple in the chin, the wide-set eyes and delicate line of the nose. Yet somehow, put them all together and her face looked... less. Less beautiful, less striking, less special. Combine this effect with a woman's drab clothes, the gray wool skirt and simple white blouse and... no. No, it wasn't her. Mrs. Richards? The girl's mother looked up.
Yes?
You can go in now. Your husband's awake. Mother and daughter filed out of the waiting room. As they passed the look-alike woman, both stole surreptitious glances. Close up, she looked even smaller. It was almost as if she projected anonymity, the same way that other people, stars, gave off charisma or sex appeal.
Poor thing, said the mother. She's like a little mouse. I wonder who she's visiting.
Grace was glad when the woman left. It was still only 7 in the morning. She'd expected and hoped to find the waiting room empty. It was getting harder to be around people. Any people. Soon she would leave America for good. Find somewhere peaceful, a retreat where nobody knew or cared about her past. A monastery, perhaps, in Spain or Greece, if they'd have her.
They'll have me. That's what they do, isn't it? Offer sanctuary to sinners, to criminals and the poor. I qualify on all the accounts.
According to her new lawyer, she'd been entitled to federal compensation eventually. It could be a considerable sum of money, not as much as you've been used to, but perhaps certainly 7 figures. Grace wasn't interested. Whatever the government gave her, she would send directly to Karen Willis and Cora Buds. She owed them her freedom, a debt that no amount of money could hope to repay. Besides, Grace had no use for money. All she wanted was to get away, but she couldn't leave yet. Not till she knew he was all right. Not till she had a chance to explain. She touched her scar on her arm, from where the bullet had sliced into her. She had 4 similar scars, all on her right side, on her leg, hip, and shoulder.
Lucky to be alive.
That's what the doctor said. And Grace had smiled and wondered, am I? Am I lucky? It was amazing how quickly the body could heal, but the spirit was not so resilient. Without Lenny, Grace Brookstein no longer knew what she was living for. The story of the shootout at Lake Hockhorn and the sensational killing of John Merivale and capture of Lenny Brookstein had gripped the entire world. The Madagascan authorities made a token effort to prevent the Americans from flying Lenny back to the United States, but a personal phone call from the president, along with some promises of substantial U.S. investment in various Madagascan infrastructure, swiftly changed their minds. Harry Bain briefed the local press. Mr. Brookstein is returning to his home country of his free will for urgent medical treatment. Once he recovers, if he recovers, his future will be determined by the U.S. Justice Department. It was Bain who'd gotten hold of the police and sent reinforcements to Le Cocon that day. Once he finally heard of Mitch's messages, he got right on the phone to the chief of police in Antananarivo and filled him in on everything. It would have helped if you had been honest with us about your presence in Madagascar in the first place, the police chief said stiffly. We could have helped. Harry Bain had to grovel to get him to agree to send men up to the estate, but thank God he had. By the time they got there, Lenny Brookstein had been shot in the stomach and groin. Had Grace aimed a little higher, she would have severed his coronary artery and robbed America of its most sensationalistic and shocking trial since, well,
since her own. As it was, after extensive surgery, Lenny survived. Before he knew where he was, the FBI had him heavily sedated and shipped back home on a military plane. It was over before you could say human rights violation. Never mind miscarriage of justice. For 2 weeks, it was unclear whether Mitch Connors would be so lucky. His life hung in the balance. Grace was terrified that it was a stray bullet of hers that had lodged itself in Mitch's spine, but the cops assured her it was John Merrivale who had almost killed him. When the police showed up, they screamed at him to drop his weapon, but John continued firing indiscriminately at Grace and at them. They had no choice but to take him out. At first, Grace was happy when she heard John was dead. But as the weeks passed, her happiness faded. What did it matter? What did any of it matter? John's death, Lenny's trial for fraud and murder, and sentence of death by lethal injection, her own presidential pardon. None of it was going to bring her old life back or help the people who'd been ruined by Quorum. None of it was going to make Mitch Connors get well, or bring Maria Preston or Andrew or that poor homeless soul from Nantucket back to life. The whole thing was so utterly, utterly pointless. Justice had become a mere word, letters on a page empty of meaning. There could be no justice, no closure, no satisfying ending. The whole thing was a farce, a game. Grace herself had been pardoned, not because she was innocent, but because it was too much of an embarrassment for the authorities to admit she'd escaped from custody twice, and that it was she, not they, who had found Lenny and uncovered the truth about the Quorum fraud. I am convinced that Mrs. Brookstein was as much a victim of her husband's duplicity as the millions of others who suffered at his hands, said the president, and America applauded. Of course she was, poor thing. They had their villain now, their pound of flesh. Lenny Brookstein was being sent to Supermax in Colorado, the toughest prison in the land, home to the most dangerous Islamic terrorists and deranged child killers. The play was in its third act, and suddenly there was a vacancy for a convincing tragic heroine. Who better to fill it than Grace? After all, the show must go on. A nurse tapped Grace on the shoulder.
Good news. He's awake. Would you like to go in?
Mitch looked pale and thin, horribly thin. Grace tried not to look shocked. He must have lost 40 pounds. When he saw her, he smiled.
Hello, stranger.
Hello.
There was so much to say, but in that moment Grace couldn't think of a single word. Instead, she took Mitch's hand in hers and gently stroked it.
They told me you testified against Lenny at the trial.
Yes. I didn't have to go in person. They let me give a statement.
He got the death penalty?
She nodded.
So your testimony must have helped.
I doubt it. He admitted everything anyway. Once they knew about the murder, the die was cast. I think he wanted people to know how clever he'd been. He didn't seem upset at the trial. It was almost as if he were enjoying himself.
Mitch shook his head in disbelief. He still doesn't see himself as guilty, does he?
Not in the least.
She paused.
They're executing him today, you know. He waived all his rights to appeal.
For a few minutes they were both silent. Then Mitch said,
I know this is going to sound like a ridiculous question, but do you still have any feelings for him knowing, you know, that he's going to die, does it upset you?
Not really.
Grace looked thoughtful.
It's not so much that I have no feelings for him. It's more that I have no feelings, period. I'm numb.
Mitch squeezed her hand. It takes time, that's all. You've been through so much.
To tell you the truth, I don't know if I want to feel any more. I want peace.
She stared out of the window. It was late May, and spring was on its last glorious flush, the trees on the sidewalk exploding with blossoms, the blue skies alive with birdsong and joy. Grace thought, I'm happy that life goes on. That's beautiful, but I can't be a part of it anymore.
Do you know who called me the other day?
Mitch shook his head. Who?
Honor. The FBI told her about Jack and Jasmine. He's decided not to seek another term as senator. They're getting a divorce.
She called you to tell you that?
Grace laughed.
I know. As if we could pick up where we left off. That's actually what she said to me. Can't we be sisters again? Connie and Mike moved to Europe, so I guess she feels alone. Lenny said something similar, actually, in the garden at Lake Hocon. He thought I was going to stay there with him and John, that the three of us could hide out in the Madagascar together and live happily ever after, like old times. That's what he said.
Are you kidding me?
Mitch's eyes widened.
What did you say?
I didn't say anything. I shot him.
Grace grinned, and Mitch remembered everything he loved about her.
She thinks she's dead inside, but she's not. She's just hibernating.
Grace stood up and moved toward the window. Mitch watched her, her graceful dancer's walk, the fluid ballet of her limbs. While he was a cop and she was a fugitive, he'd forced himself to keep a lid on his feelings. Now that it was all over, he could no longer hold them back. Longing hit him like a punch in the stomach.
I love her. I want her. I can make her happy.
What?
Grace turned around and stared at him accusingly. Mitch blushed. Had he spoken aloud? He must have. He propped himself up higher on the pillows.
I'm in love with you, Grace. I'm sorry if that complicates things, but I am.
Grace's face softened. She was fond of Mitch, after all, and he had risked his life to try and save hers. There was no reason to be angry with him, but love? No. She couldn't love again, not after Lenny. Love was a fantasy. It didn't exist. Mitch said,
I think we should get married.
Grace laughed out loud.
Married?
Yes. Why not?
Why not?
Grace thought about Lenny, about their beautiful wedding on Nantucket, her happiness as a young bride, her hopes and dreams. They hadn't just been crushed. They'd been incinerated. Annihilated, scorched to dust and ashes along with the trusting, happy girl she had once been. By nightfall, Lenny would be dead. Grace could no more marry again than fly to the moon.
I will never get married again, Mitch. Never.
Hearing her say the words, Mitch knew she meant them.
I'm leaving.
Mitch felt his stomach lurch. Panic gripped him.
Leaving? What do you mean, leaving? Leaving where? Leaving the room?
Leaving the country.
No, you're not. You can't.
I have to.
But why? Where would you go?
Leaning forward,
Grace kissed him just once on the lips. It was a short kiss, not sexual, but loving, almost maternal. It made Mitch want to cry.
I don't know where I'll go. Somewhere quiet and remote. Somewhere where I can live simply and in peace.
This is bullshit.
You can live simply with me. He took her face in his hands, willing her to listen to him, to love him, to let herself believe he loved her.
I can do simple. You want simple? You should see my apartment. It's so simple they repossessed my furniture.
Despite herself, Grace smiled. It was a tiny chink in her armor. Mitch jumped on it.
You like that? Hell, if simple's what you're into, I'm your guy. I can even do flat broke, cold Domino's pizza for breakfast. You got it. With a little more effort, I can probably get them to cut off the electricity. We could sit in the dark under a blanket and hum.
Stop it, Grace giggled.
Mitch brought her hand to his lips, kissing each of her fingers in turn.
I tell you what. I'll forget about marriage if you forget about leaving the country. Just say you'll have dinner with me when they let me out of here.
Grace hesitated. Come on. One lousy dinner. You owe me that much, at least. It was true. She did owe him.
All right. One dinner. But I can't promise you anything.
Chapter 40. Lenny Brookstein looked at the straps on the bed and felt his insides liquefy with fear. He told himself it wasn't death that frightened him. It was dying like this, on someone else's terms. But now that he was actually here, he realized what a self-delusion that was.
I don't want to die. I want to live.
No!
He panicked, trying to back out of the room.
I can't do it! Help me!
Strong, young male hands restrained him.
Easy!
He forced himself to calm down. The room was clean and white and sanitized, like a hospital. The three men inside it looked like doctors with their blue scrubs and face masks and their clear plastic gloves, but they weren't here to heal him. After all the years of struggle, in the end, it had to come to this. He would have appealed his sentence had there been even the slimmest hope of success, but Lenny was shrewd enough to know that there wasn't, and too proud to play a game he could not win. Besides, what were 10 more years of life in jail worth to him? He'd already lost 10 pounds, and he'd only been here a matter of weeks. You wouldn't give the food at Supermax to a dog. Two of the doctors started to help him up onto the gurney, but he shook them off angrily.
I'll do it!
He lay down on the gurney. The doctors fastened the straps. Lenny was embarrassed to find his legs were shaking. He had once controlled a business empire worth more than the gross national product of some countries. Now, he was not even the master of his own body. He turned his head and saw the prison rabbi standing awkwardly in the corner of the room.
What's he doing here? I said I didn't want anyone.
The rabbi stepped forward.
They're going to sedate you in a moment, Lenny. I wanted to give you a chance to pray with me, or if there's anything you'd feel you'd like to say.
No.
It's not too late to repent of your sins. The Lord's forgiveness is infinite.
Lenny closed his eyes. I have nothing to say. He felt the sharp prick of the IV in his arm. For a second, the terror welled up again. He wanted to vomit, but his stomach was empty. His bowels, too, thank God. A few seconds later, the sedatives began to do their work. Lenny felt his heart rate slow, and a warm, sleepy feeling creep over him. He thought about his mother.
She was wearing the one pretty dress she owned, a floral Liberty print, and she was dancing around the kitchen. And his father was drunk again and yelling at her, "Rachel, get in here!" And then he staggered in and hit his mother, and Lenny wanted to kill him. He thought about the Quorum Ball. It was 1998, and he was untouchable, a god, watching Wall Street's lesser mortals compete with one another just to be near him, to touch his clothes or hear him speak. He wished his mother could have been there. He thought about Grace, her trusting, innocent face, her glorious naked body that had once been his delight. She was talking to him, singing in that sweet child's voice of hers.
"I don't want children, Lenny. I'm so happy as we are. There's nothing missing."
And he opened his mouth to tell her he loved her, and there was nothing missing from him either. But then her face changed, and she was old and sad and angry, and she was pointing a gun at him, not just pointing, but firing over and over and over. Bang, bang, bang. And John Merrivale was screaming, "No!" But the shots kept coming. He was on the boat, exhausted, the axe still in his hand. He tried to stand, but he couldn't. He was slipping everywhere. The deck was slick with blood and water from the storm, and the boat was lurching, rocking wildly, and he was sure he was going to go overboard. And he looked up, and there was the chopper fighting against the wind like a giant insect. And Graydon lowered the rope, and he was climbing, hanging on for dear life, pulling himself up, up into the heavens. And Graydon was gone, but his mother was there again. "Come on, Len. You can do it, darling. You can do anything you want to." And he cried out, "I'm coming, Ma. I'm coming. Wait for me." And her arms were around him, and he had never felt happier in his life. The rabbi looked at the doctors.
"Is that it?"
"That's it," said one. "He's gone." "Not fair, is it, for a heartless butcher like him to die with a smile on his face? He should have suffered." The rabbi did not reply, but walked sadly away.
Epilogue.
Grace walked out of the hospital and down the street. New York looked its most beautiful in the spring sunshine, as vibrant and alive as she had ever known it. The streets were thronged with people, rushing about the business of life as if it mattered. It was at once familiar and strange, like walking through a dream that she had had many times before. She was alive. She was free. Grace understood that these things were supposed to make her happy. She wondered if they ever would. Looking back over her shoulder at the hospital, she thought fondly of Mitch Connors. Mitch was a good man, a kind man. Grace had sensed that from the beginning. In another life, a different dream, I could have loved him. But that chance had passed, blown away like a feather in the wind. She knew she would never go back. Would she really go abroad? Probably. Or perhaps she would simply fade away here, as she had before, disappear into the comforting anonymity of the city. Turning the corner, Grace Brookstein walked toward the subway. The crowds on the sidewalk opened up to let her in, then closed around her like a womb. She was gone. That was Sidney Sheldon's After the Darkness by Tilly Bagshaw, read by Caitlin Thorburn. Thank you for listening to this HarperCollins audiobook. This title was recorded and produced by Green Bank Studios.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this program.